My companions and I approached closer to Serpentine Lane. The vibrations in my upraised hands grew stronger, more pronounced. As if by a magnet, I was pulled toward the right side of the road. Reaching the entrance of a certain house, I was astounded to find myself transfixed. I knocked at the door in a state of intense excitement, holding my very breath. I felt that the successful end had come for my long, arduous, and certainly unusual quest. The door was opened by a servant, who told me her master was at home. He descended the stairway from the second floor and smiled at me inquiringly. I hardly knew how to frame my question, at once pertinent and impertinent. "Please tell me, sir, if you and your wife have been expecting a child for about 6 months?" "Yes, it is so." Seeing that I was a Swami, a renunciate attired in the traditional orange cloth, he added politely, "Pray inform me how you know my affairs." When he heard about Kashi and the promise I had given, the astonished man believed my story. "A male child of fair complexion will be born to you," I told him. "He will have a broad face, with a cowlick atop his forehead. His disposition will be notably spiritual." I felt certain that the coming child would bear these resemblances to Kashi. Later I visited the child, whose parents had given him his old name of Kashi. Even in infancy he was strikingly similar in appearance to my dear Anshai student. The child showed me an instantaneous affection, the attraction of the past awoke with redoubled intensity. Years later the teenage boy wrote me, during my stay in America. He explained his deep longing to follow the path of a renunciate. I directed him to a Himalayan master who, to this day, guides the reborn Kashi. Chapter 29. Rabindranath Tagore and I compare schools. Rabindranath Tagore taught us to sing, as a natural form of self-expression, like the birds. Bholanath, a bright 14-year-old lad at my Anshai school, gave me this explanation after I had complimented him one morning on his melodious outbursts. With or without provocation, the boy poured forth a tuneful stream. He had previously attended the famous Tagore School of Santiniketan, Haven of Peace, at Bholpur. "The songs of Rabindranath have been on my lips since early youth," I told my companion. "All Bengal, even the unlettered peasants, delights in his lofty verse." Bola and I sang together a few refrains from Tagore, who has set to music thousands of Indian poems, some original and others of hoary antiquity. I met Rabindranath soon after he had received the Nobel Prize for Literature, I remarked after our vocalizing. I was drawn to visit him because I admired his undiplomatic courage in disposing of his literary critics. I chuckled. Bola curiously inquired the story. The scholars severely flayed Tagore for introducing a new style into Bengali poetry, I began. He mixed colloquial and classical expressions, ignoring all the prescribed limitations dear to the pundits' hearts. His songs embody deep philosophic truth in emotionally appealing terms, with little regard for the accepted literary forms. One influential critic slightingly referred to Rabindranath as a pigeon poet who sold his cooings in print for a rupee. But Tagore's revenge was at hand. The whole Western world paid homage at his feet soon after he had translated into English his Gitanjali, Song Offerings. A trainload of pundits, including his one-time critics, went to Santiniketan to offer their congratulations. Rabindranath received his guests only after an intentionally long delay, and then heard their praise in stoic silence. Finally he turned against them their own habitual weapons of criticism. "Gentlemen," he said, "the fragrant honors you here bestow are incongruously mingled with the putrid odors of your past contempt. Is there possibly any connection between my award of the Nobel Prize, and your suddenly acute powers of appreciation? I am still the same poet who displeased you when I first offered my humble flowers at the shrine of Bengal." The newspapers published an account of the bold chastisement given by Tagore. I admired the outspoken words of a man unhypnotized by flattery, I went on. "I was introduced to Rabindranath in Calcutta by his secretary, Mr. C. F. Andrews, who was simply attired in a Bengali dhoti. He referred lovingly to Tagore as his Gurudeva. Rabindranath received me graciously. He emanated a soothing aura of charm, culture, and courtliness. Replying to my question about his literary background, Tagore told me that one ancient source of his inspiration, besides our religious epics, had been the classical poet Vidyapati. Inspired by these memories, I began to sing Tagore's version of an old Bengali song, "Light the Lamp of Thy Love." Bola and I chanted joyously as we strolled over the Vidyalaya grounds. About 2 years after founding the Ranchi school, I received an invitation from Rabindranath to visit him at Santiniketan in order to discuss our educational ideals. I went gladly. The poet was seated in his study when I entered. I thought then, as at our first meeting, that he was as striking a model of superb manhood as any painter could desire. His beautifully chiseled face, nobly patrician, was framed in long hair and flowing beard. Large, melting eyes, an angelic smile, and a voice of flute-like quality which was literally enchanting. Stalwart, tall, and grave, he combined an almost womanly tenderness with the delightful spontaneity of a child. No idealized conception of a poet could find more suitable embodiment than in this gentle singer. Tagore and I were soon deep in a comparative study of our schools, both founded along unorthodox lines. We discovered many identical features: outdoor instruction, simplicity, ample scope for the child's creative spirit. Rabindranath, however, laid considerable stress on the study of literature and poetry, and the self-expression through music and song which I had already noted in the case of Bola. The Santiniketan children observed periods of silence, but were given no special yoga training. The poet listened with flattering attention to my description of the energizing yogodo exercises and the yoga concentration techniques which are taught to all students at Ranchi. Tagore told me of his own early educational struggles. "I fled from school after the fifth grade," he said, laughing. I could readily understand how his innate poetic delicacy had been affronted by the dreary, disciplinary atmosphere of a schoolroom. That is why I opened Santiniketan under the shady trees and the glories of the sky. He motioned eloquently to a little group studying in the beautiful garden. "A child is in his natural setting amidst the flowers and songbirds. Only thus may he fully express the hidden wealth of his individual endowment. True education can never be crammed and pumped from without, rather it must aid in bringing spontaneously to the surface the infinite hoards of wisdom within." I agreed. The idealistic and hero-worshipping instincts of the young are starved on an exclusive diet of statistics and chronological eras. The poet spoke lovingly of his father, Devendranath, who had inspired the Santiniketan beginnings. "Father presented me with this fertile land, where he had already built a guest house and temple," Rabindranath told me. "I started my educational experiment here in 1901, with only 10 boys. The £8,000 which came with the Nobel Prize all went for the upkeep of the school. The elder Tagore, Devendranath, known far and wide as Maharishi, was a very remarkable man, as one may discover from his autobiography. 2 years of his manhood were spent in meditation in the Himalayas. In turn, his father, Dwarkanath Tagore, had been celebrated throughout Bengal for his munificent public benefactions. From this illustrious tree has sprung a family of geniuses. Not Rabindranath alone, all his relatives have distinguished themselves in creative expression. His brothers, Gogonendra and Abhinendra, are among the foremost artists of India. Another brother, Dwijendra, is a deep-seeing philosopher, at whose gentle call the birds and woodland creatures respond. Rabindranath invited me to stay overnight in the guest house. It was indeed a charming spectacle, in the evening, to see the poet seated with a group in the patio. Time unfolded backward, the scene before me was like that of an ancient hermitage, the joyous singer encircled by his devotees, all aureoled in divine love. Tagore knitted each tie with the chords of harmony. Never assertive, he drew and captured the heart by an irresistible magnetism. Rare blossom of poesy blooming in the garden of the Lord, attracting others by a natural fragrance. In his melodious voice, Rabindranath read to us a few of his exquisite poems, newly created. Most of his songs and plays, written for the delectation of his students, have been composed at Santiniketan. The beauty of his lines, to me, lies in his art of referring to God in nearly every stanza, yet seldom mentioning the sacred name. Drunk with the bliss of singing, he wrote, "I forget myself and call thee friend who art my lord." The following day, after lunch, I bade the poet a reluctant farewell. I rejoice that his little school has now grown to an international university, Viswabharati, where scholars of all lands have found an ideal setting. Where the mind is without fear and the head is held high, where knowledge is free, where the world has not been broken up into fragments by narrow domestic walls, where words come out from the depth of truth, where tireless striving stretches its arms toward perfection, where the clear stream of reason has not lost its way into the dreary desert sand of dead habit, where the mind is led forward by thee into ever-widening thought and action, into that heaven of freedom, my father, let my country awake. Chapter 30. The Law of Miracles. The great novelist Leo Tolstoy wrote a delightful story, The Three Hermits. His friend Nicholas Rerich has summarized the tale as follows. On an island there lived three old hermits. They were so simple that the only prayer they used was, "We are three, thou art three, have mercy on us." Great miracles were manifested during this naive prayer. The local bishop A came to hear about the three hermits and their inadmissible prayer, and decided to visit them in order to teach them the canonical invocations. He arrived on the island, told the hermits that their heavenly petition was undignified, and taught them many of the customary prayers. The bishop then left on a boat. He saw, following the ship, a radiant light. As it approached, he discerned the three hermits, who were holding hands and running upon the waves in an effort to overtake the vessel. "We have forgotten the prayers you taught us," they cried as they reached the bishop, "and have hastened to ask you to repeat them." The awed bishop shook his head. "Dear ones," he replied humbly, "continue to live with your old prayer. How did the three saints walk on the water? How did Christ resurrect his crucified body? How did Lahiri Mahasaya and Sri Yukteswar perform their miracles?" Modern science has, as yet, no answer, though with the advent of the atomic bomb and the wonders of radar, the scope of the world mind has been abruptly enlarged. The word impossible is becoming less prominent in the scientific vocabulary. The ancient Vedic scriptures declare that the physical world operates under one fundamental law of Maya, the principle of relativity and duality. God, the soul life, is an absolute unity. He cannot appear as the separate and diverse manifestations of a creation except under a false or unreal veil. That cosmic illusion is Maya. Every great scientific discovery of modern times has served as a confirmation of this simple pronouncement of the Rishis. Newton's law of motion is a law of Maya. To every action there is always an equal and contrary reaction. The mutual actions of any two bodies are always equal and oppositely directed. Action and reaction are thus exactly equal. To have a single force is impossible. There must be, and always is, a pair of forces equal and opposite. Fundamental natural activities all betray their mere origin. Electricity, for example, is a phenomenon of repulsion and attraction. Its electrons and protons are electrical opposites. Another example, the atom or final particle of matter is, like the Earth itself, a magnet with positive and negative poles. The entire phenomenal world is under the inexorable sway of polarity. No law of physics, chemistry, or any other science is ever found free from inherent opposite or contrasted principles. Physical science, then, cannot formulate laws outside of Maya, the very texture and structure of creation. Nature herself is Maya. Natural science must perforce deal with her ineluctable quiddity. In her own domain, she is eternal and inexhaustible. Future scientists can do no more than probe one aspect after another of her varied infinitude. Science thus remains in a perpetual flux, unable to reach finality. Fit indeed, by B.K. Maitru in Kalyana Kalpataru, a guru and disciple. Forest hermitages were the ancient seats of learning, secular and divine, for the youth of India. Here a venerable guru, leaning on a wooden meditation elbow prop, is initiating his disciple into the august mysteries of spirit. To formulate the laws of an already existing and functioning cosmos, but powerless to detect the law framer and soul operator. The majestic manifestations of gravitation and electricity have become known, but what gravitation and electricity are, no mortal knoweth. To surmount Maya was the task assigned to the human race by the millennial prophets. To rise above the duality of creation and perceived the unity of the Creator was conceived of as man's highest goal. Those who cling to the cosmic illusion must accept its essential law of polarity, flow and ebb, rise and fall, day and night, pleasure and pain, good and evil, birth and death. This cyclic pattern assumes a certain anguishing monotony. After man has gone through a few thousand human births, he begins to cast a hopeful eye beyond the compulsions of Maya. To tear the veil of Maya is to pierce the secret of creation. The yogi who thus denudes the universe is the only true monotheist. All others are worshipping heathen images. So long as man remains subject to the dualistic delusions of nature, the Janus-faced Maya is his goddess, he cannot know the one true God. The world illusion, Maya, is individually called avidya, literally, not knowledge, ignorance, delusion. Maya or avidya can never be destroyed through intellectual conviction or analysis, but solely through attaining the interior state of Nirvikalpa Samadhi. The Old Testament prophets, and seers of all lands and ages, spoke from that state of consciousness. Ezekiel says, 43:1-2, afterwards he brought me to the gate, even the gate that looketh toward the east, and, behold, the glory of the God of Israel came from the way of the east, and his voice was like a noise of many waters, and the earth shined with his glory. Through the divine eye in the forehead, east, the yogi sails his consciousness into omnipresence, hearing the word or Om, divine sound of many waters or vibrations which is the sole reality of creation. Among the trillion mysteries of the cosmos, the most phenomenal is light. Unlike sound waves, whose transmission requires air or other material media, light waves pass freely through the vacuum of interstellar space. Even the hypothetical ether, held as the interplanetary medium of light in the undulatory theory, can be discarded on the Einsteinian grounds that the geometrical properties of space render the theory of ether unnecessary. Under either hypothesis, light remains the most subtle, the freest from material dependence, of any natural manifestation. In the gigantic conceptions of Einstein, the velocity of light 186,000 miles per second dominates the whole theory of relativity. He proves mathematically that the velocity of light is, so far as man's finite mind is concerned, the only constant in a universe of unstable flux. On the sole absolute of light velocity depend all human standards of time and space. Not abstractly eternal as hitherto considered, time and space are relative and finite factors, deriving their measurement validity only in reference to the yardstick of light velocity. In joining space as a dimensional relativity, time has surrendered age-old claims to a changeless value. Time is now stripped to its rightful nature, a simple essence of ambiguity. With a few equational strokes of his pen, Einstein has banished from the cosmos every fixed reality except that of light. In a later development, his unified field theory, the great physicist embodies in one mathematical formula the laws of gravitation and of electromagnetism. Reducing the cosmical structure to variations on a single law, Einstein reaches across the ages to the rishis who proclaimed a sole texture of creation that of a protean Maya. On the epochal theory of relativity have arisen the mathematical possibilities of exploring the ultimate atom. Great scientists are now boldly asserting not only that the atom is energy rather than matter, but that atomic energy is essentially mind stuff. The frank realization that physical science is concerned with the world of shadows is one of the most significant advances, Sir Arthur Stanley Eddington writes in The Nature of the Physical World. In the world of physics, we watch a shadow graph performance of the drama of familiar life. The shadow of my elbow rests on the shadow table as the shadow ink flows over the shadow paper. It is all symbolic, and as a symbol the physicist leaves it. Then comes the alchemist mind who transmutes the symbols. To put the conclusion crudely, the stuff of the world is mind stuff. The realistic matter and fields of force of former physical theory are altogether irrelevant except insofar as the mind stuff has itself spun these imaginings. The external world has thus become a world of shadows. In removing our illusions we have removed the substance, for indeed we have seen that substance is one of the greatest of our illusions. With the recent discovery of the electron microscope came definite proof of the light essence of atoms and of the inescapable duality of nature. The New York Times gave the following report of a 1937 demonstration of the electron microscope before a meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. The crystalline structure of tungsten, hitherto known only indirectly by means of X-rays, stood outlined boldly on a fluorescent screen, showing 9 atoms in their correct positions in the space lattice, a cube, with 1 atom in each corner and 1 in the center. The atoms in the crystal lattice of the tungsten appeared on the fluorescent screen as points of light, arranged in geometric pattern. Against this crystal cube of light, the bombarding molecules of air could be observed as dancing points of light, similar to points of sunlight shimmering on moving waters. The principle of the electron microscope was first discovered in 1927 by D.R.S. Clinton J. Davison and Lester H. Germer of the Bell Telephone Laboratories, New York City, who found that the electron had a dual personality partaking of the characteristic of both a particle and a wave. The wave quality gave the electron the characteristic of light. And A, the law of miracles, search was begun to devise means for focusing electrons in a manner similar to the focusing of light by means of a lens. For his discovery of the Jekyll-Hyde quality of the electron, which corroborated the prediction made in 1924 by de Broglie, French Nobel Prize-winning physicist, and showed that the entire realm of physical nature had a dual personality, Dr. Davison also received the Nobel Prize in Physics. The stream of knowledge, Sir James Jeans writes in The Mysterious Universe, is heading towards a non-mechanical reality. The universe begins to look more like a great thought than like a great machine. 20th century science is thus sounding like a page from the Hoary Vedas. From science, then, if it must be so, let man learn the philosophic truth that there is no material universe, its warp and woof is Maya, illusion. Its mirages of reality all break down under analysis. As one by one the reassuring props of a physical cosmos crash beneath him, man dimly perceives his idolatrous reliance, his past transgression of the divine command, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me." In his famous equation outlining the equivalence of mass and energy, Einstein proved that the energy in any particle of matter is equal to its mass or weight multiplied by the square of the velocity of light. The release of the atomic energies is brought about through the annihilation of the material particles. The death of matter has been the birth of an atomic age. Light velocity is a mathematical standard or constant, not because there is an absolute value in 186,000 miles a second, but because no material body, whose mass increases with its velocity, can ever attain the velocity of light. Stated another way, only a material body whose mass is infinite could equal the velocity of light. This conception brings us to the law of miracles. The masters who are able to materialize and dematerialize their bodies or any other object, and to move with the velocity of light, and to utilize the creative light rays in bringing into instant visibility any physical manifestation, have fulfilled the necessary Einsteinian condition: their mass is infinite. The consciousness of a perfected yogi is effortlessly identified, not with a narrow body, but with the universal structure. Gravitation, whether the force of Newton or the Einsteinian manifestation of inertia, is powerless to compel a master to exhibit the property of weight, which is the distinguishing gravitational condition of all material objects. He who knows himself as the omnipresent spirit is subject no longer to the rigidities of a body in time and space. Their imprisoning rings pass not have yielded to the solvent, I am he. Fiat lux. And there was light. God's first command to his ordered creation, Genesis 1-3, brought into being the only atomic reality, light. On the beams of this immaterial medium occur all divine manifestations. Devotees of every age testify to the appearance of God as flame and light. The King of kings, and Lord of lords, who only hath immortality, dwelling in the light which no man can approach unto. A yogi who through perfect meditation has merged his consciousness with the Creator perceives the cosmical essence as light. To him there is no difference between the light rays composing water and the light rays composing land. Free from matter consciousness, free from the three dimensions of space and the fourth dimension of time, a master transfers his body of light with equal ease over the light rays of earth, water, fire, or air. Long concentration on the liberating spiritual eye has enabled the yogi to destroy all illusions concerning matter and its gravitational weight. Thenceforth he sees the universe as an essentially undifferentiated mass of light. Optical images. Dr. L. T. Trolland of Harvard tells us, are built up on the same principle as the ordinary half-tone engravings, that is, they are made up of minute dottings or striplings far too small to be detected by the eye. The sensitiveness of the retina is so great that a visual sensation can be produced by relatively few quanta of the right kind of light. Through a master's divine knowledge of light phenomena, he can instantly project into perceptible manifestation the ubiquitous light atoms. The actual form of the projection, whether it be a tree, a medicine, a human body, is in conformance with a yogi's powers of will and of visualization. In man's dream consciousness, where he has loosened in sleep his clutch on the egoistic limitations that daily hem him round, the omnipotence of his mind has a nightly demonstration. Lo! Therein the dream stand the long dead friends, the remotest continents, the resurrected scenes of his childhood. With that free and unconditioned consciousness, known to all men in the phenomena of dreams, the God-tuned master has forged a never-severed link. Innocent of all personal motives, and employing the creative will bestowed on him by the Creator, a yogi rearranges the light atoms of the universe to satisfy any sincere prayer of a devotee. For this purpose were man and creation made, that he should rise up as master of Maya, knowing his dominion over the cosmos. And God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth." In 1915, shortly after I had entered the Swami order, I witnessed a vision of violent contrasts. In it the relativity of human consciousness was vividly established. I clearly perceived the unity of the eternal light behind the painful dualities of Maya. The vision descended on me as I sat one morning in my little attic room in Father's Gupper Road home. For months World War I had been raging in Europe. I reflected sadly on the vast toll of death. As I closed my eyes in meditation, my consciousness was suddenly transferred to the body of a captain in command of a battleship. The thunder of guns split the air as shots were exchanged between shore batteries and the ship's cannons. A huge shell hit the powder magazine and tore my ship asunder. I jumped into the water, together with the few sailors who had survived the explosion. Heart pounding, I reached the shore safely. But alas! A stray bullet ended its furious flight in my chest. I fell groaning to the ground. My whole body was paralyzed, yet I was aware of possessing it as one is conscious of a leg gone to sleep. At last the mysterious footstep of death has caught up with me, I thought. With a final sigh, I was about to sink into unconsciousness when lo, I found myself seated in the lotus posture in my Gupper Road room. Hysterical tears poured forth as I joyfully stroked and pinched my regained possession, a body free from any bullet hole in the breast. I rocked to and fro, inhaling and exhaling to assure myself that I was alive. Amidst these self-congratulations, again I found my consciousness transferred to the captain's dead body by the gory shore. Utter confusion of mind came upon me. Lord, I prayed, am I dead or alive? A dazzling play of light filled the whole horizon. A soft trembling vibration formed itself into words, what has life or death to do with light? In the image of my light I have made you. The relativities of life and death belong to the cosmic dream. Behold your dreamless being.